Always Record, episode 141.
Have you seen Attack on Titan? Have you heard of that?
The anime?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the first few episodes.
Yeah, it's a lot of intense eye acting, and a lot of yelling. But it's really good. I liked it. I watched the whole first season. So it gets a little repetitive sometimes, but the overall mythology is really cool. And it's intense enough to keep pulling me back, so... I think the first season, it's interesting. All the episodes are only like 20 minutes.
I gotta be honest. So like my wife's younger sisters are really into anime, and they were trying to get me to watch that for a while. And I'll be honest, I only made it through the first few episodes. I have a very low tolerance for action-oriented things.
Yeah, it's very oriented towards that.
But I did like the ideas behind it, like the sort of corrupt politician and the sort of like people living in a lie, and you know, where does, you know, the elite live using the populace as human shields, and there's a lot of really cool ideas like that just sort of put a really strong statement on the story.
And the monsters are really interesting, or the Titans, which seem to be just sort of like a symbol of Western consumerism, sort of like brain dead, bloodlust, weird, sexually amorphous creatures, sort of mindlessly at the gates trying to eat people. And they're pretty horrifying as a villain. And then there's like certain ones that are abnormal, and so they can like jump around and do weird shit, while the other ones are just kind of slow and weird. But it's just it's just really interesting. It's a weird juxtaposition of art styles. Like you have this classic anime, and then the Titans are this sort of, I don't even know what school it falls into or what, how do you describe it, but it just seems like two different art styles layered over each other. And so it's like these two interacting worlds that it's very surreal. And so despite its trappings as just like overly action oriented and overly dramatic or melodramatic as anime tends to be, it has enough strong suits that it kept me watching. So I don't know. It's just been a while since I guess a show inspired me to keep watching it past the first few. So, but I recognize your criticisms, but I had wondered because I know you.
It's not even necessarily a criticism. It was a personal, like, I don't know if that's even a taste or what you'd call that. It's just like I said, it was hard for me to feel pulled. It's almost like I kept feeling pulled out by the action. But that's totally on me. Like I recognized the value in it, but like I'll watch. I said I'm really not trying to take away anything. But it's like when I watched like The Matrix, right? I remember being like in the theater going, this is a really cool concept. And then there'd be like a 5-minute car chase and like a 10-minute shootout. And I'm just like, all right, when is this over and we can get back to the interesting stuff?
Yeah, right.
And that's, I joke around sometimes that I have a one explosion per movie limit. The minute there's a second explosion in a movie, I'm like, all right, I'm done here.
Yeah.
But that's my own pretentious bullshit, so.
No, it's not a bad rule of thumb.
So you said there was two seasons?
No, there's only one, but it's kind of long because the episodes are short. So I think there's like 20 episodes.
Gotcha. I see they were making like a live action version of that.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, I did see some commercials for, I don't, I mean, I don't know what how official it was. Maybe it was fan made. I really don't know. I did see some footage sort of making its rounds. But again, I wasn't sort of intrigued enough by the anime to pursue when it sort of came across my feed to really look into it that much.
Yeah. But that's, I guess, the last thing I watched, and that was, I guess, the last thing I was trying to deconstruct in any meaningful way.
Well, I've seen I think I've seen enough and I'm familiar enough that if there was something, an insight or anything you wanted to share, I feel
No, there.
able to talk about it.
No, oh, of course. But again, I don't even know enough about the anime tradition. I took once I took sort of a class in it, not necessarily, but a project was deconstructing an article or various articles on anime and what it emerged out of is the social context in Japan after World War II, especially. So you had stuff like, excuse me, you had stuff like Firefly, which is very right after the bombs are dropped and like the survive, it's a survivor story. And even like Godzilla and so on and so forth. It's definitely in that same vein and tradition, and I like the way it pays homage that way without being too obscure. It's kind of straightforward, but it's also just highly, there's a high mysteriousness factor associated with it, which I like. Just this total, it leaves a potential for like a lot of exploration. So the immediacy of the story, it's like it rushes this intense situation on you, but there's this huge like background of unknowns that's left to explore. So I like when any story does that as well.
It's funny because as a kid, I really did enjoy Godzilla films. And I don't know if it was just I was in Japan and sort of like it changed. I'm sort of looking at it differently because there's plenty of that here in the States. But I remember being like on a bus through the Japanese countryside, looking out the window and seeing like stretching farmland and then see sort of like giant, what do you call those? Like those towers that connect, I don't know, like phone and power lines.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know what they're called.
Trying to
Just
think,
power.
what is the lyric to the Godzilla song? He's pulls the spinning high power tension line. I don't know, whatever. Do you know that song? Blue Oyster Cult, Godzilla.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I was sort of like the idea of being there, sort of as it was probably like because I could have had the same realization here in the States, but it was just like. The idea of like the technology, these big metal monstrosities encroaching on the farmland sort of rang home to me. I was like, oh, I really get the environmental message of a Godzilla, more so than ever before.
Right.
That this was this sort of like the spirit of nature saying, like, get your shit out of here, or like, you're encroaching on us. And
Yeah,
go ahead.
and one was just with the Titans and how they were personified. It seemed like an obvious sort of shot across the bow. It's, oh, our culture is getting overly commoditized and monetized to the point where it's like we're producing these mindless zombies that just sort of consume each other. And so it's part of the same vein of others, zombie culture phenomenon, things like why are we so obsessed with Walking Dead? I haven't been paying too much attention to the news lately, but what is the big story lately? Like this emphasis on drones are all drones. I thought that was interesting. It's just like serendipitous that way. That be a meaningful news story at the moment I choose to pay attention to it. So,
Well,
yeah.
the thing with the zombie, like, so I don't know. I feel like zombie culture and like zombie zombies have become a genre of their own in a lot of ways. But you know, you think back to like the is that Night of the Living Dead, the one that takes place in the shopping mall. So there's the original black and white, and then there's the quasi sequel, the first like color one, where it's they're trapped inside the shopping mall, and it's such like a really clear and poignant statement on consumer culture, that even though I don't see that being used the same way anymore, the sort of archetype of the zombie, I think, was sort of clearly labeled in that film, and you could still easily transpose that message on, or that sort of idea onto the zombies, even though everything that's been made since then, or most of the things that have been made since then, are more action oriented. You know, you're sort of 28 Days Later, and you know,
Right.
what was the I Am Legend and stuff like that, right? You know, when you had the fast zombies and stuff like that. It's definitely a change from the slow, the creeping. And in a way, it's almost like if you take that same analogy, even though it's not as explicitly used, it's like the zombies have sped up, where it was this slow encroach, even Godzilla was this slow encroaching behemoth, but now it's like a plague of locusts. It's like this fast, like you didn't even realize that they were coming, and they've already fucking destroyed everything.
Yeah. Well, it mirrors like the acceleration of information and that
Totally.
whole theory. And it seems to be mirrored in our consciousness in a way, at least in a, when bounded in a certain context, like when consciousness is put in a certain society or a certain, within a certain technological paradigm, it accelerates or, I guess, projects itself in certain ways. And for sure, it's like the acceleration of our movies and the ADHD phenomenon and everything. It's just, maybe information influx goes hand in hand with that, so it might lead to pathological symptoms rather than like this great utopia that we're so hoping for with information. Like, we can only filter so much anyway, so really, what's the point of like the overload? It's almost pointless. It becomes like a consumerism in and of itself to chase information.
Digital locus.
Yeah, but I feel like one a lot of the time. So I guess that's why I disengaged for a bit as much as I could. I haven't completely, like, I'm still, I've got this fancy new phone, so I'm like tapped into that sometimes, and I try not to be, but it's like so fucking convenient.
I know. I've resisted a smartphone for so long, and I know I've totally, I mean, not totally, but I feel like I've succumbed. And I don't mean to make it a dramatic statement, but like the addiction of, like, I don't know how to even say, like, just the need to check it. You know, like that in itself, this sort of like weird reflex of, you know, temp, you know, if I have my phone sitting next to me or it's in my pocket and I'm doing something and suddenly I just feel the need to pull it out of my pocket and look at it, and it's like, why? Why am I doing that?
It's the addiction is amazing. The it's so it runs so deep, and you just do it so automatically. Those are the real like teachable moments when you're watching yourself and you just do these things. You know, like, why can't I resist doing that? Oh yeah, that's what, because addicts can't resist doing things. So I'm like just hardwired to be looking at something blinking or whatever. It's so fucked up, but hard to break from. I'm like, even, I'm sure I've said this before, but even looking at tabloids, like I'm at the supermarket or something, and I just am bombarded by tabloids. And I don't want to look at them, but it's like I'm waiting in line. I'm just, I guess, because boredom too is a symptom of the basically over socialized psychoses. I get bored. I get bored waiting in line sometimes, and I have to fight to look at these stupid things. I don't want to look at them. I don't want these people in my mind. I don't want any news about them anywhere near me. Yet, like, still, I feel compelled to sometimes, and it's bizarre.
So I totally sympathize with that, but it's interesting that, so I've never bought a tabloid in my life, and I don't know what their sales numbers are like. Like, do people actually purchase it? But it's almost like the... Even though they haven't got me to sell, they haven't sold me the physical object of the magazine, they're still selling everyone their culture, right?
Yeah.
The celebrity culture. So as long as I've heard of a Kardashian, in a way they've won.
Yeah. That's why I was trying not to know the name of, like, the print, the new prints or whatever. And I went for quite a while without knowing the name, and then someone dropped it on me and I was really pissed off about it. But I played that game. I'm like, how long can I keep this at bay, this piece of pop culture bullshit that I don't want? But I feel we'll inevitably infiltrate that.
So speaking of prints and pop culture, I mean, I had a really interesting conversation. It was my father-in-law's birthday this weekend, so I spent some time with him Saturday night. And we got into a conversation. So I'm in an interesting place in Virginia. So, like, where I am is, like, super military. Like, you know, like, military bases and stuff. You know, NASA, all that sort of shit. But Melissa's parents live about, like, 45 minutes west of here. They live near Williamsburg, which is basically dependent on tourism based around, like, these colonial areas that they've tried to preserve and stuff like that. And they'll have, like, reenactors, you know, and shit like that. Like, people who walk around like they're living in colonial times. Anyway, we were discussing, like, I don't know how to even get to the heart of the conversation quickly, but it was a number of things. Of, like, so we have the access to everything. In one respect, we have more leisure time than most human beings have had throughout history.
I don't know. That may or may not be true.
Okay.
Like, we have more leisure objects. I don't know if we have more leisure time.
Well, okay. So, I would love to hear you sort of tear that argument apart, but this is what I was trying to say is, like, even though I still work a tremendous amount of hours, so I was actually trying to figure out if this was true or not. Like, we are still, we are debt slaves. Most of us are wage slaves that are dependent on a tremendous amount of time. And yet at the same time, I guess what I was also trying to think is, like, probably you had to work your field, feed your farm animals, you know, chop your firewood, all these things that we don't have to do probably required more time. And that could be an ignorant statement, so I'd love to hear an argument against that. But I was thinking it was really only the sort of wealthy aristocrats that had a ton of leisure time. And I feel like modern Americans, even if they're stuck in their jobs, which does consume a tremendous amount of time, I do feel like all our modern conveniences allow us extra leisure time that's I would think is unprecedented in history. You know, if it's, say, you have to run a washing machine, but you're not physically sitting there washing the clothes. You can throw the stuff in, push a button, walk away. You know, how many people have dishwashers and stuff like that? So all the things that are sort of doing work for you, or if I'm pressed for time and I don't feel like cooking dinner tonight, I can order a pizza, I can order Chinese food, I can, right, all the sort of convenience there. And it was this idea that, like, the wealthy class had the leisure time. They had the time to explore different opportunities. You know, most of them probably wasted their time with prostitutes and gambling and distractions, basically. If you got the money and the free time, you're going to just sort of throw it away. But then you have a handful of people who are saying, I'm going to figure out how electricity works, or I'm going to... So it's not so much that, you know, like, why do these many inventions come out of the elite? It's like, well, they're the ones who had the time and the money, the resources to put behind it. Whereas a sheep herder could have invented something, but he might not have the resources to build a laboratory to develop it, you know?
Right.
So the ideas, I feel like humanity as a whole is capable of brilliant ideas, but maybe the only ones with the leisure or the resources were the ones who were able to actually act on it, because they weren't worried about survival and sort of pragmatic issues.
Definitely in the industrial era, that holds true, no doubt.
But then what I was sort of thinking is, so if you, there's a few different ways we could attempt to extrapolate that into the modern time. If modern day Americans have extra leisure time and have, well, they might not have financial resources, but they have the ability to share information over the internet, we could see how this tremendous leap in, again, maybe it's just technological or industrial advancement, but how things could accelerate that instead of having, you know, one or two Lord Byrons sitting around wanting to put their time into figuring out a discovery, you could have 10 million Americans sitting around trying to develop something. And maybe it's a product of boredom, or just, again, just the opportunity that leisure affords you. But
well, that's why something like a guaranteed income is so interesting, because it would guarantee a baseline of, okay, you won't starve, or you'll have your necessities met, and then there's room to achieve over that baseline, and you can also, or use that space just to invent and be creative or do things, right? So the society would be built more around entrepreneurship and not fear-based, like, decision-making and stuff. So that's very interesting, like, as really the baseline, because as much as spirituality requires a detachment from the material world, it's like you're saying, in a lot of instances, leisure or some sort of security is necessary to facilitate exploration.
Oh, so, totally, right. Why did, you know, the Enlightenment came out of the upper class, so why we have concerns about the Illuminati, right, is like, these were the guys who had the time and money and power that they could sit around and explore the mysteries of the universe, and yet, so, that, you know, these are not monks who gave up all their money. They're like, no, my bills are paid, servants cook me dinner, I'm going to sit here and try and read this Egyptian text or study Freemasonry or, you know, whatever the fuck, right?
Right.
So there's like some really interesting sort of interplays happening there with economy and spirituality and exploration. What is it? Is that Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Yeah, that's a well-known way of evaluating the needs hierarchy.
So, you know, something like that. So those people who have all those needs taken care of, then they can pursue their sort of spiritual pursuits.
Or the individuation process too, right?
Because totally.
I feel like they kind of go hand in hand. So you can call it spirituality or whatever, but really it's like, I guess, falling in love with your own God nature. So if that's like your religion to yourself, if you're doing it right, I think. But maybe that's a little self-centered.
Well, and it's kind of hard to feel connected to your God nature when you're like cleaning up shit for the guy who's getting in touch with his God nature.
Yeah, I know, it's absurd.
So that's right. So it's like, you know, we see this really strong interplay there. But then, you know, the same way, so there's a few other tangents to this. One is the same way that most of the aristocrats didn't go into intellectual or humanitarian pursuits. They went into distraction and hedonism is a strong word, but you know what I mean? Like just basically distraction, I think is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, how do you fight the boredom? Now that all your needs are met, how do you fight the boredom? So as we see with most people nowadays, they're fighting their boredom with cell phones, Facebook, whatever. Not particularly stimulating things, but just distractions to get you through the fucking day. So in the same respect, as we might have unprecedented leisure time, most people won't know what to do with that. Not that there's a right or wrong answer, but most people will sort of have to find ways to squander that leisure time. While other people are pursuing methods to get more leisure time. If we could just come up with this new invention, people wouldn't have to do X, Y, Z, and they could have more free time to pursue blank, right? Well, what are they actually pursuing? So it's a numbers game in a lot of ways. But then there was another interesting idea that came up was he was saying... So, like, again, since he's in Williamsburg, where they have all these sort of colonial sort of fetishes, he was saying that there's like a sort of argument about how things were. It's the assumption that we know, by we have certain records of a slice of history, and then we extrapolate that we understand that culture. So we have the records of, you know, 200 British noblemen living in the colonies. Therefore, we know what life was like in colonial America.
Right.
But, you know, his argument was, of course we don't fucking know. And, you know, and the further back you go, the more we attempt to try and say we know what it was like in ancient Egypt or whatever. You know, this Romanian village that we unearthed and we found two pieces of clay pottery and therefore we know that this is how they made their pots. Well, did everyone make it like that?
Right.
You know, was that, you know, I know right now I have two different, very different cups sitting on my desk. One's a coffee cup, one was a soup bowl. If they only found the soup bowl, you might say they drank coffee out of giant fucking mugs, you know. I'm mostly joking, but you get the sort of idea that like that we extrapolate information at a very small data set, and then we attempt to pull a bigger picture out of it. So he was saying like since the wealthy guy would have his portrait taken, he might have had a diary that was preserved. His house might have been preserved, whereas the poor person couldn't afford to get their portrait done, couldn't afford essentially couldn't afford a legacy, right? So it's almost in a way, in like a non-conspiratorial but a systematic pragmatic way, which is just as fucked up, mind you, the culture, our entire culture with every generation is more and more ingrained in the indoctrination of this is what our culture is, which is based on the elite culture because it's the culture that gets preserved. Since everything else fades out, but these, you know, the cathedral still remains. The portrait of Henry VIII still remains. But we don't know that much about Shoemaker Joe. and what he may or may not have thought. So it's sort of like, then as we think about our own history in terms of identity, even a cultural identity, we're basing it on the culture of the aristocracy, even though we weren't. I'm not a direct descendant of aristocrats, obviously. It's not my social strata, and yet it's hard to separate ourselves when we think, what are we descendants of? Well, I think I know what life was like 100 years ago, 200 years ago, etc. But in the same sort of way of like the winners of the war write the history, the winners of media longevity write the history. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Misty just pointed out to me that it's like, people have, okay, no one pointed out to me, I formulated it on my own.
She doesn't want to take credit for your crazy bullshit idea.
No, it's very
don't say what I just said.
It's very practical. It's just, it's interesting. Yeah, it's like culture makers have always been sort of that upper strata for the most part, right? And if not started there, seemingly it has been, I don't know, co-opted is such, I think I was arguing over that word yesterday about what it suggests or what it, why I don't like it or something, because it suggests like total takeover, but it's just like everyone uses similar ideas or similar or the same symbols for different ends, but it's just, they're just technologies, so everyone's in a tug of war over them. But anyway, it's just, it's amazing that people, there's so many people that are tired of being like sort of manipulated and lied to and so on and blah blah blah. That's why, I don't know, it's something absurd, like only 20% of people would re-elect their congressman. It's like no one trusts politicians. Everyone is, no one likes anything, but everyone is so easily swayed just through like words and ideas. It's like propaganda is the ultimate magic. It's the ultimate thing, because you can always win without superior numbers, whereas really if it's a numbers game, it's like the oppressed are so much more. There's so many more. Like, how does it even work? How does this even work? So I can see why stuff like even Bohemian Grove exists. It's just because they're like, how couldn't you be obsessed with that sort of power? That's power. That's fucking crazy power. Like, you've made the world at Western, at least Western world is, I guess, 20% of the population or something of the world, technically speaking. And then a lot of shit, it's just like Western money and culture is infiltrated almost everywhere. But I guess what defines the first world is about 20% of the population. It's just totally weird, like a snow globe dimension.
It really does tie in with your sort of Attack on Titan thing, where you have this sort of mindless, almost animalistic mass population devouring things, and yet there's the idea of the wealthy power elite sort of attempting to shape that or utilize that unthinking power to their advantage as much as possible. And there's a certain practicality in that as well. Like, let's say, so again, even in America, we don't have a caste system, but we say middle class, upper class, you know, we have very clear hierarchy in place. And if you have, you know, let's even take a guy who's, let's not make him super wealthy. Let's take a guy who's worked, you know, 60 years old, worked a corporate job. Maybe he owns a house or two, right? You're sort of American guy who kind of made it, right? Maybe he's got two cars in the garage. He's doing pretty well for himself. He wants to stay at that social status or rise. He doesn't want to go down, right? So he's going to do what he can to preserve his social status and try and pass that along to his children and his children's children, if possible. Well, the same way, if you're fucking Queen of England, you're going to do what you can to say that social status for your children and your children's children. It's almost like a human nature that doesn't, even though it reaches a point when you're the Queen of England, that you really don't fucking need more. That same sort of basic instinct, I think, would probably kick in.
Yeah, it's like, what's the long game? What's the long game, ultimately?
It's, well, it's like, all just self-preservation.
Yeah, it's also game playing. I feel like it's like humans are the game playing mammal. It's like, what is the long-term game? It's like, to preserve my DNA. Yeah.
Everything that's alive plays that game.
Yes. But I feel like humans...
That's because you are a human. You have no other experience than being a human.
Yeah, so does that taint all... I mean, does that taints all analysis, that taints, right?
Everything.
So can we not come to any...
That taints everything.
So is there no consensus, like even mild consensus?
I like the word taint.
Taints are disgusting things. So anyway, moving on. I don't know. That's a good question.
Whatever. Taint, nothing wrong with that.
Quit being so self-loathing.
Whatever.
I mean, Misty, I think you were sort of agreeing with, and I don't know if we're completely on the same page, but yeah, the idea that it seems like, so to me, it also felt like self-preservation, like was a very natural instinct, which doesn't require anything sinister. Like, you can throw sinister on top of it.
No, that instinct is totally beyond good and evil. It's just a natural fucking process. Life wants to be life.
Precisely. And anything that would sort of lower our quality of life is automatically deemed, like, the instinct sees that as a threat to life itself.
Exactly.
Oh, I won't have... I won't have... Like, so I actually knew somebody... It's funny, my, I don't know if this is a good thing to put on a recording. So, like, my mom grew up in this town with this woman. These two little girls grew up the same block, and they grew up together, and they still remain friends. And my mom is living by herself, works ton of hours, is in pretty dire straits financially. Like, everything's falling apart around her and has been for years. That's how I grew up, and it's probably actually gotten worse for her.
Mm-hmm.
Her friend married a guy who ended up doing very, very well for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the motherfucker, like, they had, like, a mansion. Like, my mom's renting an apartment that's falling apart, like, literally mm-hmm. falling apart. Her friend lives in a mansion.
Yeah.
Right? Pretty different, you know, whatever. And a few years ago, like, when the stock markets, you know, oh, there's a big, you know, everyone's freaking out, the economy's falling. And my mom was trying to tell me, oh, I feel so bad for them. You know, right. he had just bought a yacht.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got to sell it, and he never got to really enjoy it. And they're going to have to sell... Bear in mind, it's a husband, a wife, and one child living in this mansion with a bunch of spare rooms that they don't ever use, and they had to get, like, housekeepers to take care of the rooms that they never go in. Like, what is the fucking point of that, right? But so they had to move down. They had to move down to a smaller house and sell their yacht. And she was like, you know, this is really a shame. And I was like, Mom... Do you hear what the fuck you're saying? Like, why the fuck? Like, they are still totally fine. They are so good. They are doing great. And all things considered, they're doing fucking great. Like, you don't have to worry about them. Worry about yourself.
Well, it's a couple of things, but yeah.
Right, but, you know, she was, you know, maybe in a sympathetic or maybe a more intelligent analysis than I'm giving. It's the idea that, like, right, but... It's still, to them, it's a huge loss.
Yeah, but also to the spectator it is, too, because everybody... So, like, if that programming to rise higher and higher is in you, and you see someone that you're close to that you love succeeding and achieving that, you may, of course, be like, I wish I had that for myself, but also you delight in their success. So it's an empathetic response to the fall, which I think is also innate. Like, that's just, I mean, I guess, I don't know. Yeah, so I would just leave it at that, say that I think it's an empathetic response to the fall. And also, people just don't like, because also then it's like you, it's like counter to your programming in a way, because you have to accept that, I don't know, I guess you, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, let's even say something came along in the American economy that knocked everyone down one rung on the ladder.
Right.
You know, the people at the lowest rungs feel that even if we all got demoted one step, the people at the bottom feel that harder than the people on the higher rungs, because you might go from two cars in your garage to one car in your garage. But if you go from like two meals a day to one meal a day, that's harder.
Right. I'm not talking about the relativity of the specifics. I'm more talking about like just the psychological reaction.
Totally. And I guess what I'm, I think I'm trying to distinguish those two things to say, like, on an emotional level, yes, on a practical level, that, like, so I think we, yeah, I totally get why emotionally it would feel the same. And, like, quantitatively, it's the same, right? Everyone's demoted one class or something. But I think what I'm saying is that if let's say we're all in a swimming pool, right? That you have like the kiddie end of the pool and the deep end of the pool.
Yeah.
And we're all standing in, you know, side by side, shoulder to shoulder in a line. And if we suddenly raise the volume of the pool 1 foot, the person standing in the shallow end went from getting their kneecaps wet to their tip of their dick wet.
Right.
You know, the person who was like gasping for air is now drowning.
Yeah.
So we all felt the foot, maybe on an emotional level, we all felt it equally. I don't know. I'm not trying to argue. It's more like I'm just talking, trying to sort of navigate the different aspects of it.
Yeah. I get you.
I don't know that there's a point there. just a sort of feeling around the...
But I guess real quick, just as a brief explanation for why I said the leisure time thing. At certain times and places, it doesn't hold fast or anything, but it's anthropologically, it's been explored. That depending on the agricultural work and what have you, I mean, a lot of it was actually relatively low impact. Not to say it didn't require a lot of skill and expertise and hard work, but the better you get at it, the more streamlined it gets and so on and so forth. So no great innovations came out of, I guess, agricultural free time, because it wasn't is obsessed with like the control of things, right? Like, so it's like obsessing over manuscripts and building on scientific concepts, Aristotle and what have you, you know, that fell into the hands of a certain group that had time and money to throw into stuff. Whereas like just peasants with time don't have any ability. They don't have the money or the whatever, the political power in a sense, if money is power, which it is. In most societies. So anyway, they had time. It's just like not much came out of it, just because, well, what are they there? They're not producing anything. So, and the way time is spent now, it's like filled again. We got the 8-hour workday or something, but when you really think of commuting and everything else, I mean, that adds more time.
Why are we talking about product?
Product?
You said produce anything. The lack of time means you don't have time to produce things.
Like, I guess produce in that I mean be an architect of something meaningful, and that can be a lot of different things.
Does I don't know, like the just I was thinking about this a couple weeks ago. I saw some feminist meme or something that said something to the effect of like, don't put too much value in the in like what you produce. It I don't even remember what the meme said, but all that it translated to in my brain was the idea that putting value in the things that you produce is still a virus of like a capitalist mentality.
True.
Totally, yeah.
Like even like as an artist, like you know, I can look at the things that I do and be like, they're my artistic output, but it's still the value that I surrender to that product in terms of who buys it, how much I sell it for, how much time I invest in it, is still it's still a capitalist
Yeah. Of course, yeah. I mean, I don't want to take that
way
for
of
granted.
looking at.
Of course.
So I don't know, like I just I'm like right now I guess I'm having like a problem with like the value of like material products and
Which, yeah,
everything.
which I think we were actually trying to get at earlier was the idea that we are this is so ingrained in us culturally to think in these terms, that it's hard to kind of escape that.
Yeah, possible. What
But
is it? I don't know.
right, I mean
What's the
I think it's certainly inspiring to try to break out of that programming, but I think, you know, sort of across the board,
It's
maybe
not.
maybe there's things you can do on an individual level to not, you know, if at least, you know,
No.
let's say it's your art, you know, to not at least keep that as something sacred that you don't cram that onto.
And it's like every, yeah, I mean,
It's
everything,
just compartmentalizing, but yeah.
well, everything in moderation, I guess. It's not like I think I said this to someone yesterday that I think there could actually be an organic consumerism and a type of consumerism that with proper controls and what have you, it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be as destructive as it is. And so operating through that psychological thinking space or something wouldn't be as, it wouldn't make me feel as bad if it wasn't like ending up in landfills and stuff, like the our products or whatever, or however we think of that, whatever we're a part of. Like hemp
Kathy,
could, you know, go ahead.
I want to throw you something. So this guy at my job, he was talking to me about, so there's some like billionaire who made the 5-hour energy drink, right? And he's donating 90 something percent of his billions to charities and inventions and stuff, right? And one of the
Which is amazing
invention
how,
was
I'm
it?
sorry to butt in, but just, it's amazing how little gets to people at the bottom of those chairs. Like,
Sure. I mean, yeah, you know, I don't know the specifics of what he h how he set up that donation and whatever. But basically, he
no.
made umpteen $1 billion and was going to keep just 40 million for himself, was more than enough, and give the rest away, right? And so, which is, you know, is pretty interesting. It's again, it's not meant to slight the man. That's still a, you know, whatever.
No,
You know,
as
you could, you, I could be the cynic of me is like, what a fucking tax! He probably figured all the taxes he'd have to pay. Probably save, you know, probably as a, you know, whatever. Do the calculation, whatever. I could be cynical about it, but just the point is, so this guy at my job says. He goes, one of the inventions that they're building with this money is this bicycle that you can get on this bicycle, you put this bicycle in your house, and you pedal the bicycle for 1 hour a day, and it provides you with 24 hours of electricity for your whole house.
Yeah.
Right? And I looked at him, and I know what my electric bill is.
Cute butt.
Huh?
And it'll give you a cute butt.
No, it's not a bad idea at all. But what I'm saying is, I looked at him square in the eye, and I said, let me ask you something. Would you, let's say you have, so that you think this is a great invention, would you use it? I said, how much is your electric bill a month? And he said, about like 40, 50 bucks. So basically, that costs you about $1.50 a day to power your house using pollutants and slave labor. Or, you know, how many of us are saying, I'll gladly work for $1.50 an hour. Again, these are the calculations that most people do. So when I just posed him with the question of, do you think you would actually use such a thing? He's like, and I didn't give him the number games. I already done this. I quickly calculated this in my head, and I just sort of was wondering if he would catch. And I said, he's like, no, you know, my electric bill is like really only like 40, 50 bucks a month. He's like, I don't think it would be worth it for me to do that. Like I could go to work and make more in an hour that I can more than cover my electric bill and then some. So yeah, it doesn't really work. That really wouldn't work for me. And I thought, here again is one of the problems facing us is when do we, I know certain people, like sort of financial activists, have tried to put in the idea of like what's called real cost, where you would say, well, okay, it might cost you $40, but what does it cost in pollutants and slave, you know, all the invisible costs of things. But right. Again, for the average person who's, again, this isn't a wealthy guy, he's working in the same shitty job I am, he's thinking, you know, I need every fucking penny I get. You know, I'm not going to fucking, it's again, and this guy, you know, just like most of us, could use to be on a bicycle for an hour a day. I know I fucking could, but again, it was just sort of like, it's where we, societally, we are challenged by a good idea, but we're still the instinct for more leisure time. I'm not going to give up an hour of my leisure time to do that. Do you get what I'm saying? It's a, you know, you do those cost comparison, it's cheaper for you to just send the money to Con Ed and they'll take care of it.
Yeah. It's like immediate return on investment. What's the most immediate return?
Well, it's because we're still an infantile savage race.
Yes!
Fucking kidding. There's
we are titans devouring the land.
And so it's all about immediate gratification. Everyone knows that.
Everybody knows that, and maybe they do. They're not doing much about it.
Well, no, but if you're terrible too, and you realize, I don't know, like, do 2-year-olds in the height of their tantrums and craziness, are they self-aware? I don't know.
So, do we ever grow? Do we grow up? Does the species grow up, or are we just gonna like?
No, we just go. Go 0 to 2.
We're gonna find Daddy's gun and shoot ourselves in the face.
And then we go to 0 again. It's just 0-2, 0-2.
Wow. We don't even get to adolescence. We don't get to experience much. So that's
speaking
pretty...
of numbers. Wait, can I just ask real quick, Misty? Are you intentionally making the number 5 with your body in this photo?
What photo?
The photo that I'm looking at on Skype.
I have no idea what photo that is. I don't remember what my thing is. Oh, is it the one with... Yeah. Oh, I think...
Your right arm is over your head and your left arm is sort of across...
The mat
across
photo.
Your, across you to your hip.
I think I was... I think I was channeling my inner Cheshire kitty cat.
Because it's pretty clearly the number 5.
Yeah.
Like, from what I'm looking at, like, all I can see right now is the number 5.
Yeah.
Your sort of collarbone, sort of, that shadow continues across your shoulder and then comes back to your arm.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
Yeah.
You're not impressed. I thought you were the fucking...
I don't want to be 5 anymore.
Oh, you don't want to be 5 anymore. What's your new number? Change the picture. What's your new number?
Yeah, I don't know. I need a new picture.
7?
No.
Because you were all about the quintessence and the...
Yeah.
But you're beyond that?
That's 17, though.
Five is the four elements plus the quintessence, so it is still 5, even though it doesn't.
Well, it's 5 and 17, I guess, in the same, because so the fifth element is Q, but it's also, as we know from the movie, the fifth element, love. So it's both.
So you do like 5.
It's okay.
She still likes 5.
If you move down to 7. Do you know, if you look at a clock in, like, military time, when it's 5 p.m., the clock will say 17?
What?
5 plus 12, of course. It's 5 p.m.
Yeah, when you see a clock that says 17, ooh, it's telling you that it's 5.
That's interesting. Mm. Misty's once again, I could tell impressed, but grudgingly impressed.
I'm not, I mean, yeah, it's nice. That's nice. It doesn't surprise me.
I know, it's not surprising. I turned on an episode of Futurama last night. It was awesome.
God, that was insane.
Just like all this, like the sink, you know, it's cool when it just jumps at you certain times. Like you'll go to like periods.
Oh,
where...
speaking of which, so this is my weird thing. So, okay. Oh, sorry. I'll tell the story because we're talking about 17 now. So, and you guys were talking about zombies. So this works perfectly.
Right.
A couple weeks ago, or last month, sometime, I don't know. I had to pick up these suits for my job that were like deconstructed or whatever, and being sent to Las Vegas for a zombie film. And so my job was just to pick up the suits and go and package them and send them. So I go look up the closest UPS place to me. I go to the UPS place, I shove them in a box, ship them off. And right before he like takes the box and puts it in a different area, he writes the number 17 on it and circles it. And I'm like, so I ask him, I'm like, why 17? And he's like, oh, this is just the 17th box of this size, that something to that effect. And I was like, okay. And then kind of smirked at it or whatever. And then I get home and I get my tracking confirmation from UPS, and it's tracked with UPS Quantum. So there's the Q. My 17 box off. And so I just get a call today from my boss, and she's like, hey, I have a question to ask you about that zombie. Like, literally, I was just on the phone with her while you guys were talking about zombie shit genre stuff earlier in the conversation. And she goes, do you get a check for $98? And 9 plus 8 is 17, right? And I'm like, no, why? And she goes, something really weird happened on set where they got the box, and then the UPS driver instructed the producer of the film to write you a check, me, as in my name, Misty Greer, a check for $98, and nobody can figure out why. And I was like, I have no fucking clue why. Like, I looked at the receipts, I'm like, it can't be, like, duty, it's not, like, a casual delivery type of thing, like, I prepaid for the whole fucking package. And she's like, I'm gonna have to put a stop order on that check. Did you receive it? I'm like, no, I've not received $98. It's fucking weird. It's not weird. It's weird.
It is still weird.
This is my life. Like,
even though
day,
it's normal,
every
it's still
day,
strange.
This is my life.
Yeah. Strange can be normal.
It's absurd.
There's no escape.
It's exhausting.
I've also felt the complete normalization of the strange.
Yeah.
Right? Where it's like, of course this weird thing is happening to me right now. Yeah. I know you're saying this crazy, insane thing to me, and I'm supposed to be
But of course, okay. Thank you.
Par is the course.
That was just funny because it was like the, you know, like everything happens in threes. It was the third 17 in the finale of Weird, like that whole zombie thing. I don't know. It was strange.
Good timing as always.
I have closure on that 17 now.
Yeah, I love the theory of sync, that it's just you're getting towed around by your unconscious and you just put her in the right place at the right time.
I like that it's trying to send me money.
I know, that's cool too.
It's fucking awesome.
Like, my Jedi mind tricks are like manipulating people as far as Las Vegas. Like I don't even have to be just sitting in a bed with them.
It's non-local. It's like, fucking non-local.
Humans in Las Vegas are like, let's write Misty a check for $98.
She needs money for groceries. She must be taken care of. Yeah, it's the normalcy of the weird. But I don't know. What else? So, do you think that, what is it? Trip to the Moon?
Oh, God. We have to talk more about my disillusionment. It's painful.
Okay, well, so we won't go there.
Okay.
But can we talk about, what did you think of Jason's talk? Did you like Jason's talk?
No, I don't want to talk about that.
You don't want to talk about that
either. We can talk about A Trip to the Moon. Well, we can talk about Jason's event.
Well, did you think it was a success? Did you think it was good?
Yes, I think it was a success.
Yeah. He was a nice fellow.
I'm happy he was happy.
Are you having a hard time, Misty?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. This ain't fucking easy.
And Jason has a good way of reminding you of that. He does for me.
Right. It's funny, last time when Jason sort of came back into my life was sort of at the perfect time to remind me that lesson. Maybe that's, you know, he's an agent of synchronicity in that sense too. When I was on his podcast, when I was sort of at a physical and mental breaking point sort of talking to him, who has this sort of almost like morbidly depressed sort of tone about him. I don't actually get that impression that he is like that, but that's like sort of the effect that his tone has on me.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of talking to him and being like, oh my God, I know. It's all so... it's not as cut and dry as that. I don't want to.
No, but there's definitely an optimism to his work, you know? I can't help but see that.
I don't like how he Jedi mind tricked me into. Like, how in the world did I end up in a situation where I'm talking to Jason Horsley and he's preaching optimism to me? Like, that is some kind of fucked up. Like, I don't know how I got here. It's really bad. Like, that's just, that fucks with my head really badly.
I felt like he was playing the magician role quite well.
I got one up.
I think it's important. It's weird. It's like, I don't know if, I sometimes feel like a similar sort of, I don't know if it's a contrarian or like trying to remind someone of this sort of the opposite of what we do. Like when I see like a Jake Kotze is like, everything's joy. And I'm like, fuck, you know, it's not. The life is horrible. And then I meet someone like, you know, Jason Horsley, who'll be like, everything's horrible. And I'm like, no, come on, look at all the joy that there is. And it's like, is there something in that trying to push someone out of either extreme?
Yeah.
Do you mean from his point of view, he was trying to manipulate me?
Precisely. Yeah, I'm asking if that rings true at all.
I I don't know what rings true.
I'll throw you another possibility then. It's sometimes when you meet somebody who seems like they've got their shit together and they're in a good place. Like you, for example, that's certainly the impression I had of you when I met you. It was like, here's a happy person who's...
I was happy.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't want to ruin that for you. And it's like, you're like, hey, I see your point about how things kind of suck. And I'm like, no, nope. Don't do that. Don't do that. I'm doing plenty of that for both of us. You stay happy.
So you have to stay happy because we're too depressed. We can't be a depressed triad. Only two of us can be that way.
I'm not depressed.
You're the medium one. You're in the middle of the ground.
Yeah, I get depressed.
Who doesn't?
More often than I would.
I feel like it's necessary almost. Nothing's necessary. But there's always periods where it's a close neighbor. Something you flirt with, at the very least.
Oh, I've gone beyond flirting with depression.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I was going to say I've fucked depression many times, but I think it's fucked me. Right, is actually the better way to put it. I started flirting with it, and then it just spun me around, ripped off my pants, and fucked me in the ass, so.
Okay. It's definitely in my family, so I'm always aware of it. And so I wonder if an awareness of it can keep it at bay.
No, it makes it worse.
You think so?
I think it makes it worse.
What does an awareness of optimism and joy do?
Kills it.
What? It cannot. It can't kill it. It can't kill it. It just puts it in a different context.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably. But it's fair to say it could kill it. That's not impossible.
You say kill, and what's the it in the kill it? The awareness of joy kills the depression, or
it kills the headspace.
Well, it depends, because an awareness of joy implies you're outside of it. If you're talking about just like feeling joy, being inside of it very intensely, of course it amplifies it. But if you're aware of joy as a function, then that's all it is. It's just a function.
So it's the mechanization?
Yeah.
But I guess I'm trying to juxtapose. You said being aware of depression makes it worse. So, like, it's almost like a temptation. It's like if you know that the black hole is there, it might suck you in. But does being aware that the sun is over there, does that help sort of... You know, like the way a flower might gravitate ever so much towards the light, being aware of it, is it just a function or does it help to sort of give you a goal?
I don't know. It depends on how, like, I don't know.
Hey, Misty.
Yeah.
Since I don't feel like pushing you in this conversation, I want to tell you something somewhat unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
So you sent me a long message on Facebook that I didn't see till today, because. Yeah. You know how on Facebook, when someone sends you a message, you see the first sentence of something? Like, you don't have to actually open the message. It shows you, like, the snippet.
Yeah.
So I sent you, like, my phone number and whatever, and I was just like, okay, have a good night. And then I saw this thing come up, and it says, here's mine if you ever need it. And I saw your phone number, and I was just like, oh, okay, great. So now I have, if I ever need her number, I have it. But I didn't actually click it and open it and see the full number or anything. It was just like, great, that's nice. And sort of moved on. So it wasn't until I got this other message today that I opened the message, and then suddenly I see this three paragraphs that came before, here's mine. And I was like, oh my God, I hope she didn't think that I just, because I actually wish I had seen that message.
It would have answered some questions.
Well, now you have, so your wish is fulfilled.
My wish is fulfilled. I just want you to know that I did not intentionally ignore it.
I didn't think you would.
Well, good.
Why would you intentionally ignore me?
I would be a real asshole if I...
That's absurd. Nobody can. Nobody can resist.
Resistance is futile.
It is quite futile. Oh my God, there's a... I saw a Star Trek documentary today where they bring together all the captains for like some sort of communal captain, I don't know, retreat or something, and they all reminisce. I'm gonna have to watch it. I imagine it's quite awkward, but maybe they made it work.
No, they love each other. They're all friends.
Why would they be
because
friends?
Because Star Trek is magical, you asshole!
Yeah, but they're
so they get to be, if you get to be a Star Trek captain, that's fucking epic! They go down in history as captains.
Aren't they competitors for the throne?
No, there's no fucking throne!
It's an egalitarian.
There's enough enterprises to go around. They could each have.
I mean, isn't the claim that it's like a communist, you know, Star Trek is like communism pushing communism or something? So I guess there should be enough to go around for everyone. I want to watch it. That's what I'm saying.
All the captains are okay people.
Does Scott Bakula count? Is he in this?
Is he the most recent captain of like the shittiest show?
He was in the one. He was in the prequel show.
Oh yeah, he doesn't count.
Wow, is that the most
old?
Is that the most recent?
I don't know. That was the last one I'm aware of.
There
was Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and then whatever that the one after that was called, which I think might have just been Enterprise.
Oh, the Enterprise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Is that the last one?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All seven seasons that got canceled. It's the only Star Trek series to ever have been canceled.
Yeah, the guy that did it was Quantum. He was on Quantum Leap, right?
That's who I'm talking about. Yeah, it's the only reason I cared is because he was the guy from Quantum Leap, and I loved that show.
He kept this basically the same haircut for quite a while. I mean, he cut the mullet off, but it was the same essentially.
Got me through my childhood. Okay, that, Put Him on the Glass video was really all I needed when I was a kid.
Have you revisited Quantum Leap in adulthood and found all kinds of crazy shit with it, or is it still just a relic?
I actually haven't revisited it, really.
Yeah.
I think I went back and I watched part of the first episode once. Like, basically, it was around, I went through all this sort of like atom bomb time travel phase and then talked to like Joe Alexander. And then he said, oh yeah, you didn't know then the original Back to the Future script, like he traveled back and had to like get to the Trinity site, the atomic bomb explosion at Trinity to get back to the future was actually how the original script went and all this sort of stuff. So like all these, it was like all these like series of confirmation. And then at some point I decided, oh, you know, Quantum Leap, that was a great time travel TV show. I'm going to check that out. And I watched the first episode and they're like, here we are at the site of the Trinity explosion where we've built the time travel machine. And I was just like, oh my God. And I just turned it off. I was like, forget it. Forget it.
Yeah.
Like that was literally the first, I think, minute of the show was them saying all that. And I was just like, well, all right. I don't really need to watch it.
That episode with Joe, I think that was like 88, mm-hmm. I think. And we opened that show and you had just been talking about or researching the Young-Pauli connection and sort of this connection with radioactivity, the concept of like connecting sync with radioactivity. And that, you know, at the time I could only say so much about it. So I talked about like the neutrino and the implications of that, but I hadn't read much of their dialogues with each other or anything, so I couldn't comment directly on it. But what you linked me to was really interesting, but I really didn't make all the connections until more recently, like maybe a month or two ago, I read basically the collection of their exchange, Polly and Young. It's really good, really, really interesting. Polly was really into connecting scientific principles with archetypes. He was, I didn't realize it went that deep, but he put a lot of effort into that and saw the symbolism mirrored in a lot of the archetypal symbols compiled by transpersonal psychology and stuff. So it's interesting. It's like you see the symbolism for sure when you really look at it and dissect it. Scientists are just repeating the same things over and over again. Even like in complex systems theory, they're just using the Kabbalistic tree of life as the basic paradigmatic model for how networks work and systemic networks. And so that could even be extended into more modern times. But he was just doing it for like quantum physics. But even nowadays, it comes out more and more and more. But you bringing it up just for a long time, I wanted to mention that since reading it again. I'm like, oh yeah, that's awesome. And I'm finally reading the Red Book, like, because I have the Red Book, but it's so hard to read it in the big format. So I'm reading the Reader's Edition now, and it's definitely easier, but it's amazing. And I'm waiting for, like, are you still there?
Sorry, yes, I'm here. I'm just muted.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that's all I have to say. But I'm interested in, like, seeing... I would love to visit Carl Jung's, like, residence. Because he carved all this shit into stone, and it's just really fascinating. It's just, he literally lived that sort of experience. He didn't just write about it or anything. It's incredible.
I think that was the point Misty was trying to make about, like, sort of fully embodying joy rather than seeing it as a concept. Like, while I was trying to argue that the awareness of one could sort of draw you in, I do totally get the idea of a living experience versus a conceptual experience. And if anything, you know, it's one of the... I think it's one of the greatest challenges within our community is many of us are so heady, not necessarily like in the like intelligent way, but like we're head oriented, like analytical.
Neurotic.
Excuse me?
Neurotic.
Neurotic. Yeah, I thought you said erotic and I was like, well, no. Yeah, neurotic. definitely. We could do to be a little bit more erotic. But that's sort of exactly. So I think there's for me a real need to get out of our heads a little bit more and get into the actual experiential side. Where even if that becomes a sort of thing where you're doing your job and suddenly here's a 17 and it gives you a smirk. It might not be anything more than that, but that's to sort of integrate it, to live it, and to just embrace that as part of a living, waking reality.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you want me to let you guys go? It sounds like you got home, and I want you to be able to enjoy your time together.
Yeah, well, I mean, we already have, like, let's see. Once you trim out a few things, probably like an hour. So we can just take this as, like, a one cover. I hope it don't turn away.
But don't turn away. from day to day. I need a crowd of people, but I can't face them day to day. Though my problems are meaningless, that don't make them go away. A crowd of people, but I can't face them day to day. The world is turning.